I guess I'm becoming more of a cranky usability guy. I think that something happens as you get older, your love of good design is gradually, incrementally replaced by a hatred of bad design, which is slightly different.
Hello, Spacers. From Austin, Texas, I'm Christopher Schmidt, and today's show, I'm talking with Scott McCloud. Scott is the creator of the 80s comic book Zot, which won a Jack Kirby Award for the brand new series. He's the author of a comic that explains, well, the medium that is comics as a comic book called Understanding Comics, which won an Eisner Award. His latest graphic novel, The Sculptor, came out in 2015, with Sony quickly buying the movie rights shortly after its release. Before we get started with the show, some notes on where I'll be and some word from our sponsors. First up, CSS Summit. It's the 3-day virtual conference event. It focuses on CSS, SAS, and super fun technologies like SVG, animation API, design systems, JavaScript task runners, and so much more. You can ask questions directly to speakers, to colleagues. Recordings are free when you register. So in case you miss a session or miss a day due to work or what have you. So definitely buy your tickets now at cssummit.com. Uber has given me the opportunity to give you new riders a $25 credit towards your first Uber ride. Sign up at http://christopher.org/Uber to claim your credit. Also be sure to see us at CSS DevConf in San Antonio, Texas this October. You can buy tickets at cssdevconf.com. You'll be able to see Chris Coyer, Jonathan Snook, Rachel Andrew, and a whole bunch of people we've heard on the show, and much, much more. It's a really great way to get energized and see where the industry is growing. So that's going to be in mid-October, and check more out at cssdevconf.com. Also, you can set it, forget it with a non-breaking space show newsletter. So when a new episode is ready, you can have it show up directly in your inbox, signing up at newsletter.notbreakingspace.tv. As always, you can find show notes and links discussed in today's episode, and there are a lot of things we discussed in today's episode, at notbreakingspace.tv. That's where you find all the links. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at Teleject, T-E-L-E-J-E-C-T. As always, thank you for subscribing, liking, and telling others about Non-Breaking Space Show on iTunes. Also want to let you know that we're also on TuneIn, if you happen to use that app, to search for Not Breaking Space Show. But now, on with the show. Well, thank you for breaking time to be
my pleasure.
Be part of this. So yeah, last time I saw you, you were in Austin doing the book tour for for the book, for the sculptor. How is that going? How you're still? I still feel like this is like the you're still part of the book tour. So that's fine.
Well, it's now been, what is it, about a month and 3 or 4 months since it came out. A year and three or four months since it came out. So I've certainly quieted down. You know, I'm getting back to work on the next book. But yeah, the book is still out there. It's already in 12 languages.
Wow.
And it's still moving about for a big fat hardback. You know, we're still moving copies. So it's kind of nice. And we'll see what happens with the movie, which is still, you know, kind of a going concern as a possibility, but you know how Hollywood is. God only knows if it'll actually ever get made, but that process has indeed begun, just in case.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay, great. Well, that's awesome. Cause you, I also know, cause you, we've talked before, you are a movie fan and you will watch a lot of movies, which is great. And, because is in the '80s, you created Zot, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Zot. And then, which is a great story. I recommend people buying it, the back issues. And so there was talk about, you said like, hey, why don't you just, you know, I just like me, like in this decade, like, hey, why don't you make a movie as Zot? And you're like, yeah.
You're like, actually, yeah, I've said no to a few people over the years. Yeah. There've been like 4 or 5, sort of entreaties to make a Zot movie. And each time, you know, sometimes I'll get pretty close. Sometimes I'll just wave them away. But, for one reason or another, it never looked like the right opportunity. Right.
And that's one of the things like I learned about you, was just like, you like, if it doesn't feel right, or if it's not going to be right, you like, you just like, nah, I'd rather not do it.
Yeah, kind of picky that way, I guess.
Yeah, cool. Since we're on top of movies, let's give you any movies that you liked recently. I just want to just put that out there.
Actually, the movie I can't get out of my head, I didn't necessarily like, and it was The Lobster.
The Lobster? Oh, I love The Lobster. I love The Lobster. Yeah.
It was really grim, though. I went with Ivy and our friend Ricky, and we were just joking about it all the way home, how it was wasn't always user-friendly. Mm-hmm. But one of the most important measures for a movie is whether or not I can't stop thinking about it for days or weeks or months afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so far, it's doing pretty well.
Yeah.
Because I have a lot of trouble getting some of those images out of my mind. But this is a spoiler, so like turn it down, anyone who's listening. But you know, we should have consulted Does the Dog Die? You know that very useful site.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh.
That's usually a deal breaker with my wife.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Oh, man. That's dang it. Oh, man.
But
you're bringing back some memories now. So I put that one aside. But yeah.
Yeah, it's probably wise.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that. That was, we went to a film festival here in Austin for the first time. It's called Fantastic Fest.
Uh-huh.
And it's a genre film festival. And that was the keystone, I guess, if you will, like of the festival. And so I had never heard of it. And it was like September last year. And I was just like, but the person who helps run the festival is Tim Leake. And he does the Alamo Drafthouse movie theaters. So if you've heard of the Don't Talk in our theater from the PSA lady who complains about being thrown out. That's his movie theater.
That's the one?
Yeah, that's the one.
Awesome.
So he found The Lobster and he said, like, I have to bring this and share because that's his, like, that Lobster is for him is like the movie. And so I'm like, okay, I'll go watch Lobster. I'm like, I was just, I love the movie so much. And I felt like I hoped they would bring it to the mainstream audiences in America, but I felt like, I don't know if this will find a place in America mainstream.
Well, it made it to our local art house. We're out in the burbs. So that was actually something of an accomplishment.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think the thing, it falls into that very narrow category of like people like Lars von Trier and mm-hmm. things like Nymphomaniac was really kind of director versus audience. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, I am not here to please you,
right.
You know, right. You know, you just sit in that seat and I'm just going to smack you around
right.
and then like light up a cigarillo and walk away after I'm done. And had that feeling. And I felt like it's sort of, it may have unseated the cook, the thief, his wife and her lover mm-hmm. for like the quintessential, you know, just kind of like just slap you in the face art film kind of a thing, you know, right. but man, I can't stop thinking about it. You gotta give props to anything that you can't stop thinking about.
Yeah. I think that just, this movie is like, it does not like if you don't want to follow along, it's not going to help you out in any way. You're like, you have to buy the premise. If you don't buy it, then you might as well just walk out, you know?
The relationship between you and the movie, it's kind of codependent. It's like a very unhealthy relationship.
Which is about, yeah. So, yeah.
Why are you still living with that movie? Why have you not divorced that movie? Is that movie treating you well? No, and you're still sitting here.
Oh, man.
It's kind of great, though.
Yeah. Yeah. That was probably the best movie of the thing, of the festival. So, for me, I guess my contribution is it's a horror movie, slow burn, mm-hmm. Called February, and I loved it. It has you either love it or hate it, and it has a new name now because February, no one's gonna remember February as a title. But if you look under IMDb, it's really great. I don't think it's come out yet, but
do you remember what the new name is?
No, I don't. We have this thing called internet. I'll just look it up real fast.
Oh yeah!
I'll just kill a minute of my.
It's a time. Series of tubes. I heard.
Yeah,
very useful.
Yeah,
but, you know, one of the things I love about life with Ivy, my wife, mm-hmm. is the fact that we refuse to be jaded. Oh, so, yeah. Like every single day, there'll be some little thing where we'll pull out our phone and we'll just go, "Isn't that great?" You know, like you know, like using Shazam to pull a song out of the air. It's just like we refuse to get used to it. We are daily grateful
yeah.
for all the things that, You know, we tell our kids, you know, we never tell our kids, oh, things were so much better in our days. Yeah. We tell them that it just sucked. It was hard. Everything was terrible. TV was terrible. Movies was terrible. The phone system was terrible. Everything was terrible.
Oh, man. Well, there's another movie I want to talk about that. I think that would be different. But The Black Coat's Daughter is what it's called now.
Ooh.
And I think it's a terrible title. I like February better.
That's a strange name, yeah.
Yeah, it comes out July 15th, so it looks like. So, Black Coat's Daughter. But it's one where you have, for me, it was like you're trying to figure out what's going on, and then you have a theory, and then you test it with what you see for this movie, and it doesn't really prove your theory until like the very end for me. Like, and so you're like, so people like walked out just hating it because you actually had to like focus, like it's a crossword puzzle trying to figure it out. And then I felt like great because I was just like, yeah, it would not let me go. Like I had to go see what was happening next.
That sounds pretty good. I mentioned a Greenaway moment, a movie a moment ago. One of our favorite movies, the two of us, my wife and I, is Drowning by Numbers because it has that ridiculous formal constraint that the numbers 1 through 100 appear in order during the film, and you just have, and you, after a while, you know what the story is, but you're not really paying much attention to the story. All you know is that 43 is coming up, and it might be a page number, or maybe it's going to be on the side of a house, or maybe it's going to be on a marathon runner running by, but you know 43 is coming, and that's all you can think about. And I love that. That's so great.
Oh, man. All right. I have to look that one up. Cool.
That's our favorite Greenaway.
Oh yeah. So I talked about like 80s. 80s, like, so it's like, oh, that sucked back growing up. But have you seen the Raiders, the adaptation of Raiders of the Lost Ark?
You mean the Backyard Raiders, the ones that the kids did?
Yeah.
I actually saw at the Museum of Jurassic Technology in L.A.
Okay.
I saw a presentation by the director and I think one of the actors.
Yeah.
And they showed the entire thing.
Right.
They showed the actual film. And a comic book artist, Dan Klaus, was set at one point to write the screenplay of a movie they were going to make about the kids making the movie. Now, that's not what you're talking about, though. You're talking about the actual movie, right?
Yeah. So, so the actual movie that the kids made.
Yeah,
so there's a documentary about the movie.
Okay, good.
Because like 30 years, 40 years later, and that they had a Kickstarter, a crowdsourcing to finish the movie because of the stealth bomber Germany did. And so they had
I thought they did finish it. What I saw was a finished thing.
Yeah, so they have a documentary about that includes all that stuff in it that's out now. Or it's coming out now. And then they have the finished product.
Okay. All right. Hang on. All right. We're doing a disservice to your listeners because there's like half of the people listening to this have no idea what we're talking about.
Right.
So just we'll just explain real quick.
Okay.
That a bunch of kids really loved Raiders of the Lost Ark way back. This was like 30 years ago or something like that. And they decided to remake the entire movie shot for shot in their backyard. And by the time they were done, they were like borrowing submarines, having actual car chases. They went completely insane. They couldn't find a monkey, so they had their pet dog on their shoulders. And yeah, and they did it. They actually made, over the course of, what was it, like 5 years?
Yeah, 5-6 years. They actually burned down part of their parents' house.
it's like a kid-sized Burden of Dreams, you know? It's just like it's like they dragged their ship over the mountain. I love that. That's so fantastic. But I guess they wanted to do a movie, like a recreation, like a movie about them making the movie. Mm-hmm. But then there were rights issues because it is basically, you know, like a reshoot of Raiders.
It is. Yeah. So, but it's a. So we just saw a double feature of the documentary, and then we saw the finished product, like with the actual the crowdsourced making of the film. Like, so it was really surreal because you saw all these shots of the kids getting older and older, like the 80s hairdo gets in there, right? And then all of a sudden, the shot when they get out of the pyramid, out of the tomb, and then they have to fight the, you know, blow up the plane and everything like that. So everyone's like 30 years older in HD. Yeah. And then there's some scenes that are stitched in that are from the 80s as well. So like HD, 80s, you know, then HD, and then and all of a sudden, then you're back to 80s. And so, oh man, so I think some things are better in the 80s. I don't know.
Like, we live at a time though when this can exist. You know, I think that just like something that is so in its own category that belongs to no class, no category whatsoever, that the joy of it is how long it takes to even explain what it is.
Yeah.
You know, that's just like everything just fit neatly in its category when I was growing up. And now there are things that are their own categorical anomalies. And there's something just so magnificent about that. Like, you know, like trying to explain some memes, for example.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, like, what is this? Like, yeah, definitely agree with that. So if you have any more movie suggestions, let me know. We'll just break it.
They'll come up.
They'll come up. Yeah, so what are you working on right now in terms of, can you tell me what you're working on now? Or?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
I'm working slowly on a book about visual communication across disciplines.
Oh, wow.
So this is something where I'm seeing if I can distill common principles in all these different ways that we teach or learn through pictures. So everything from information graphics to data visualization to educational animation, educational comics, even facial expressions and body language, PowerPoint presentations, all these different ways. I want to see if I can figure out what are the underlying bedrock principles of sort of best practices for teaching and communicating through pictures. I'm calling it a elements of style for visual communication.
Oh wow! Okay.
So, it's a big job in terms of research. I mean, I've been researching in so many just zillions of different ways, but like I've been saying, it's sort of like I need to research a very big book so I can make a very small book. You know, I want to be sure to distill it down to something essential.
And I hate to draw the comparison out, but in some ways I feel like I have to. It's like, so how would you compare it to understanding comics? Because you do talk about a lot of the same topics, it sounds like, and understanding mm-hmm. comics to this idea, this concept.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the thing with understanding comics is I took the subject of comics and try to illuminate a lot of the underlying principles, but they weren't prescriptive. That's one of the things that made understanding comics what it was, is that it was descriptive, not prescriptive.
Okay.
You know, in the entire book, really, I almost never said, and here's how to do it well. You know, never came up. And in fact, people were frustrated with me because they thought it was going to be a how-to, and they got the book and they thought, but Scott isn't instructing me on how to tell good comics from bad, or how to draw better manga babes or whatever. You know, it's like that wasn't what it was about. Well, this time I actually am going to see, you know, just I'm going to separate good from bad for the first time. I'm actually going to say, you know what, this fire safety diagram sucks, but it sucks in a really interesting way, and it helps illuminate a lot of principles. And in what ways is it violating fundamental principles of the way we process proximity or size relationships or forms of representation? You know, why does this seem a little dissonant cognitively? Why do we have trouble resolving these shapes, whereas these shapes would have been more seamless? You know, how do we communicate much more efficiently? And it's a very different realm, because usually I try to stand back and say, well, you could do that, you could do this, you could do that. Maybe that'll happen. Maybe that'll happen. So this time it's like, no, that was wrong. Mm-hmm. That was wrong. Okay. This is why it's wrong.
Okay.
And let's make the world a better place for visual design.
So almost like a better UI, better user experience?
Yeah, it's very much in the realm of UI. And, you know, and I recently got to speak to Edward Tufte, who, even though obviously he's not, well, we don't classify what he does as UI, but of course we all know that that's, in many ways, he was a forerunner of some of those mm-hmm. aesthetic foundations that led into that sensibility.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, like that's sort of the, I guess I'm becoming more of a cranky usability guy. I think that something happens as you get older. Your love of good design is gradually, incrementally replaced by a hatred of bad design, which is slightly different.
Yeah.
And so you're much more attuned to all that is wrong out there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, in a sense, I guess you might say I'm looking at, you know, looking for chart junk. I should probably hunt up Jacob Nielsen at one point, you know. But I think it really goes. It's good to go back to first principles, you know. It's good to go back to the moment where things were at their simplest, where the world was first being created, to see maybe where we took a wrong turn, you know. I had the pleasure just a couple of weeks ago of speaking to Susan Kare, who had drawn the original Mac interface.
Awesome. You know, yeah.
She's the one who drew the trash can and the document and all. And just sort of getting a sense of, you know, all these different eras that we've been through and all these ways in which so much you know, kludgy topsoil has been dumped on top of it. And, you know, one of the things that Tufte had said, which I thought was really interesting, is he's distrustful of the idea of compartmentalized functions and jobs. You know, the idea that, oh, well, this person does this kind of visual communication, this person does this kind of visual communication. To his mind, there is the message and there's the user, the audience, and you choose whatever path will clearly illuminate information. Now, in his case, he often defaults to paper, and that's what he's been focusing on. But, you know, I want to see if I can figure out, you know, why. What is it about paper? You know, what are paper's advantages, and what design priorities that we've imported from a time of print are now floating into a different realm in which things like scarcity are no longer one of the dominant design mandates. You know, scarcity was a very big deal. You know, when we speak of things like the data ink ratio, we're talking about like how much can you get out of every square inch of paper. Well, one of the reasons you're doing that, just one, there are several, but one reason is because you don't want to waste paper.
Right.
This is not the case with pixels, but we still have that underlying those are our marching orders, right? Which is why we try to cram so much on every PowerPoint slide. We don't have to.
Well, I was going to ask you, like, you're going to say bad design, you're just going to put PowerPoint. You're just going to slide it all PowerPoint underneath.
No, design. Well, of course, you know, I actually present a lot, yeah. And I've come to really like presentation software. You know, from the beginning when I started using PowerPoint, I'm using Keynote now, but we all know it's the same thing. You know, from the beginning, I saw it as a tremendous opportunity. I was especially struck when my daughter started doing it when she was 13 years old, when we were on tour. She had a 7-minute presentation with 200 or 300 slides. And she just understood instinctively that she could use visuals and that the words were coming out of her mouth and that the visuals were synchronized to those. And she had a completely different approach to PowerPoint that really neutralized a lot of the things that we think of as the worst in that particular medium. And I've been doing that myself for many years. I've been giving visual presentations that I can go for 400 slides and never have a single list of any sort, very little text, because I don't think it's necessary, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think, as a conference organizer, I see all sorts of presentations. And so, the one I don't see that much though, like, you know, your presentation is definitely more visually, the way you describe your presentation is very unique. But there's like Lawrence Lessig, I think his name is correct. But yeah, he'll just like rapid fire, like slides are just like water, you know, just like, oh, whatever, you know.
Exactly.
Right. And so there's that style delivery. There's people who, you know, made two slides and they're done, you know, they're, mm-hmm. that's all they need to get their point across. But yeah, and then some are like in our industry, like code examples, like the demo time and so like that too. So, but yeah, I could definitely see, but where I think about like bad PowerPoint is, I'm not sure this is your example or I saw it in your presentation or not, but like the NASA Challenger explosion, when they went to go back and they figured out like what went wrong, and Tufte, I think it's Tufte actually was on the team.
That is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tufte is did indeed critique those presentations, and he reserved special ire for the PowerPoint presentation, which obfuscated the information rather than illuminating it. Now, he expanded that into a critique of PowerPoint generally. And I think some of his points regarding having one image after another, are worth considering, even beyond the horrifically bad PowerPoint presentation that they put together. You know, he has a much more generalized dislike for it, which was then countered by David Byrne, who did his I Love PowerPoint tour, and, you know, I'm somewhere in the middle. But you know, a good example, if, you know, going back to that is, you know, one way to explain my philosophy when I'm giving presentations is, if I don't need to think it, I don't need to see it. And if you apply just that simple rule to 99% of presentations out there, you realize that they're violating that almost continuously. And I think that's something where Lessig and I probably have that in common, is that we, you know, if I'm talking about something, it's going to be there on the screen as soon as I'm done talking about it and I move on to the next topic, that image is going to be replaced by the next topic. Because otherwise, I think you have a sort of a cognitive dissonance that you know, think of the typical bulleted list. Your eyes will drift inevitably to the next six things that you're going to be talking about while they're talking about number one. And you're always going to be drifting into the past and into the future because they're all sitting there. And it's very hard to stay focused on what's being discussed when there's all this other visual noise. We have this idea that when we begin a presentation, we believe that we have our words, we have the meaning of our words, we have our presentation skills, our facial expressions, our body language, all of the skills that we bring as a presenter, and we think now we can add pictures, right? But what we overlook is the fact that when you add pictures, you're starting at a deficit because you've just added a distraction. You've actually sapped some of your audience's ability to concentrate on you because now you have this other thing, like a dancing poodle over here, that's going to make it harder to concentrate on you. So you're starting below sea level. You've got to have genuine added value in each and every visual you put on that screen. Otherwise, you shouldn't have the screen at all.
That's why I feel like bands now, they have to have a TV screen behind them. And I was like, well, is that more because of a statement about us, viewer watching it, and we have ADD, or the fact that they aren't that good and we have to
look? Well, you know, it depends on the screen, right? You know, I think that I just saw, I was at Moogfest. That's where I spoke to Susan Kerr in Durham. And some of the presentations, you know, like Grimes was there, and I thought the screens were, they use them really well. Oh, yeah. And a lot of that comes back to synchronization. The idea that you're expressing the music visually can actually be really exciting.
Can you explain what Moogfest is and what happens?
Oh, sorry, yeah. Moogfest is a music festival in Durham, North Carolina, in the wake of HB7, was it? The bathroom bill that prohibited transgender people from using the bathroom of their identified sexuality or their identified gender, rather. They decided to stay, so they didn't protest. So they actually had the festival this time, but they were protesting in other ways. Interesting thing is it's named for Robert Moog, who developed the Moog synthesizer, which in the early days was most closely associated with Wendy Carlos, formerly Walter Carlos, a real transgender icon at a time when that was extremely rare in the United States. So it had an interesting... Sorry, none of that has to do with your question, but
no,
it's a music festival, and they had, you know, Reggie Watts was there, Laurie Anderson was there, as I mentioned, Grimes, Gary Newman. It's a lot of fun people, but I really liked the shows in which the visuals were, you know, carefully synchronized to the music, where they were attempting to express the music beat for beat. I think that's enormously important. I don't think that these things should just be set parallel. And you see that a lot. I love music videos too. My favorite music videos from back when they actually made music videos were always cut to the beat exactly, rather than just having, you know, some drama going on while the music is playing in the background.
Using we're talking about using visuals as a means of performance and enhancing, and so like. Yeah, so when I usually speak, I usually find out that you know, when I go through run through, it's like, oh, there's something I'm talking about here's a slide, this is what I'm talking about, and then I mentioned something else as an extra. I was like, oh, wait, I need to add that slide to that visual because people aren't going to think, they're not going to be listening to me. They're going to be actually seeing what's on the screen, so I have to go back and add that slide because otherwise they don't know what the heck I'm talking about.
Well, what you're talking about is like what I think of as the dividing line between two different presentational styles, right? One of them I call monkey bars, and the other one I call magic carpet.
Okay.
And monkey bars is where, you know what you want to talk about, and you cook up some slides that represent different topics. You throw those slides on the screen, and then as each slide comes up, it's like an outline. It's like you see that slide, and you're like, right, I remember I want to talk about this. When you're done talking about that, you throw the next slide up, and that reminds you of the next thing you wanted to talk about. And that way you can improvise, but it has some structure built in, right? But, you know, so maybe it's a little inefficient. Maybe you go on at the mouth about this thing that you didn't need to talk quite so long about, but it's all right. It's spontaneous. It's fun. But once you've done that a few times, gradually you find more efficient ways to say it. Gradually, as you're talking about this slide, you already kind of know about when the next slide's going to come up, and you know what you're going to say with the next slide. That becomes a kind of script. You don't have to write it down. You know after you've given it a few times. And that's magic carpet. The difference is monkey bars is like up comes the slide and you're grabbing on like monkey bars, right? You're hanging from your slides, right? Each new slide, you hang from your slides. Magic carpet is where you're just talking, you're walking through air with your words. And as you reach each new topic, the picture just slides up underneath your feet and replaces the last image as you go. And so it feels more seamless. And they're both valid ways to present, but the one kind of leads to the other, I think.
Yeah, if you have the same presentation, I think in our industry, if you go around speaking about it, like the more you practice it and you get more of that magic carpet feel to it. So
yeah. And then it evolves over time too. You know, you take things away. But it just sort of changes slowly.
Yeah, the most amazing one, I think it was a viral video for a while, or whatever. But it was a 7-minute presentation. But the guy, it was like sort of like a quasi keynote in France or something like that. And I didn't understand what he was saying, but he timed it to a movie. He actually made a movie, and so he had these amazing visuals. So they weren't just like static slides, or they weren't like videos on slides or GIFs, you know, memes on slides. But it was actually like this, like, trailer of something, and he was just, I was just like, I don't, man, that's a lot of effort to make that work. But
it takes a lot of rehearsal, and of course something goes wrong and it's like, okay, you're in trouble now.
So I want to get back to the new book you're talking about. Is it also sort of like design 101 type of things, like we're talking about design principles of scarcity and color schemes and color theory a little bit too? Is that also going to be in that book?
Yeah, there's definitely some 101 in there, and okay. I'll be going back and kind of revisiting some of those earliest design principles that, you know, come out of things like the Berlin School or, you know, Arnheim or, you know, like mentioning stuff like, you know, pre-attentive processing, the pop-out effect, that sort of thing. But always with a very practical eye, you know, not in terms of trying to create some kind of comprehensive picture of visual cognition, because, you know, that's changing very fast. Every year we understand that better, and every year we, you know, throw out the last theory about how it all works. So I'm not really interested in taking apart the mind, you know, the visual cortex, but I am interested in just saying, like a carpenter might, just saying, you know what, if you put the nail in like this, it's going to go in that wood more securely. You know, this is, I always like to put a level on this before we attach the parts, that kind of thing. Because, you know, as somebody who works with pictures all day long, I have a pretty good instinct for that. So if it works, it works, you know, and even if the explanation changes from generation to generation as to why it works, how we construct that meaning mentally, I'm not going to get too caught up in, you know, that individual moment of a research into cognition, because that's a fast moving target. I mean, we're learning so much so fast about how the mind processes images, and a lot of our assumptions are changing pretty continuously.
Is there anything else you want to mention right now about your new book? Because I'm already excited for it. So
cool. Well, there will be comics. It'll be in comics form, and I will be walking around pointing at things.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, the way I do. But I think that probably it'll be different in a couple of key respects. So I'm not quite sure yet. Visually, it'll probably look somewhat different from the books like Understanding Comics.
Yeah, well, I don't want to harp too much on the Understanding Comics so much, but but which is a great book. But because I feel like as an old guy, I just said I wouldn't harp on it, but I just want to say it. Just like as an old web nerd as it was, it just understanding comics is a touchstone in terms of our industry. And also you mentioned in the presentation you gave at the Control conference is that it also other industries as well. It felt like understanding comics, it just reached out.
You know, it's a little like what happened to Donald Norman and Edward Tufte is that what I found was if you take any topic, no matter what it is, and you dig in deeply enough, if you drill down far enough into your own little tiny area of expertise, what happens is you get closer and closer to the core of things. And the more obsessively you learn about any one topic, the more you find yourself uncovering fundamental topics that underlie many different disciplines. And that's what Tufte discovered. That's what Donald Norman discovered. That's what a lot of people discovered. It's just that passion for the specific leads you to the general. And I think that's just one of those things that comes up again and again. And at a time, you know, when the web was new, which wasn't that long ago, let's face it, there weren't a lot of texts. You know, people had to reach outside of their disciplines because you know, web design in 1994 didn't have a very thick library.
Right. Well, which is like one of the lessons I learned from their book was like new mediums are always judged by the old. And that's kind of funny. Yeah, like we needed old mediums to tell us what to do with the web. And or it's like, because we were web designers, they weren't really print designers for the most part, but a lot of print came in and helped us establish what we can do now. And so,
well, you know, in one respect, that was an old classic design mistake, but in another respect, I benefited from it, you know, because otherwise they never would have picked my book off the shelf. So I can only criticize it so far that they reached into other media.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Cause like it was your book and then, David Siegel, Crane Killer, websites, and then Linda Wyman's book. Yeah. It was just like, and I felt like, I wrote web design books myself, because I felt like, well, that's how you learn is like buy books on how to like design for the web, which is like, kind of crazy these days, but, cause now it's all blogs, all the stuff.
Yeah. But you know, one thing, Christopher, about that idea of our basing our understanding of each successive generation of media or technologies based on the previous technology, one thing is that that's a very long arc. And this is something that people like Paul Saffo talked about, which is that we're not talking about 3 or 4 years. It can be 20 years of approaching a new art form using certain, you know, fundamental assumptions about the old ones. You know, it wasn't that quickly that we shook off the theatrical artifacts that early movies had or got rid of what, you know, our sort of radio-based sensibility as we moved into television. It can take a very long time to overcome those things, sometimes as many as 20 years or so.
Yeah, I mean, we saw soap operas that survive, like that, they're surviving because they, I thought it was incredibly awesome that soap operas, radio, survived TV, could not survive the lack of viewership, and now they're on Hulu. Right, which is just like it blows my mind that they're on Hulu. Yeah. Right, it's just like they're on a digital platform now. They're just they're but they're that this concept is reviving. And I'm just like whoever came with this idea is immortal in some ways. Like just talk about sculptor that concept of that. But I felt like oh wow, that's amazing that they're just finding new ways to keep this show going. And some suburbs didn't make the cut, but yeah.
Well, that's the old shell and the yolk and the white of the egg, you know, like it's just that we took it all as one entity and then suddenly it's mixing in the pan and you realize, no, it was always about the stuff inside. It wasn't about the shell, you know? And that's the thing why when we were all talking about convergence in the 90s, I saw it as a cross current, you know, that you would see convergence of distribution, but you'd also see some things that were aesthetically bonded were actually going to diverge into different things. Once they were released from their original containers, you would find one aspect of a medium would be landing in one corner and another aspect of a medium would be landing in another corner. And you certainly see that with with the moving image, you know, where the distinction between TV and movie was, it was a technological distinction and it was a market distinction, but they were both aspects of the art of the moving image. And now what you see is as that's uncoupled from the device, now you realize what were the fundamental ideas. Well, there's the short stuff and the long stuff. There's the continuing stuff and the one-off stuff, you know? Those were the differences. Those were the meaningful differences.
Right. Is this like what is going to a movie theater these days? Like, is it going to see two episodes of a TV show, or is it just one long movie, or like whatever? Because even when Netflix releases a show, you know, it is like one long movie, right? It's not a TV show anymore to me. It's just like I have 13 chapters of this Daredevil's life I have to go see.
Yeah, you know. Or if you go with the British and the Canadian model, you might have three episode seasons. Like, you know, one of our favorite series was Slings and Arrows, which was either three or six per season. I can't remember. Or I think of The Singing Detective, going back, Dennis Potter's great BBC series. That was more in that realm. And it really was like a movie event. Ivy and I went to see that sort of period recasting of the modern Sherlock series, you know, with Benedict Cumberbatch in the movie theater. We went to the movie theater to see an episode of a TV show.
Oh, right. Yeah, because BBC did that for the Christmas episode, right?
Oh, no, it was for when they were back in the time of Sherlock Holmes, back in Arthur Conan Doyle era. And was that Christmas? I don't think it was Christmas. Was it Christmas?
Yeah. No, it was during Christmas time, I think they released.
It was during Christmas time, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, but oh, God. I mean, like, talk about fudging the boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was sick and I was at a fever dream and I watched it and that messed me up totally. I was just like, oh, gosh. So it's not my favorite episode because of that. Not because of the episode was bad, but I was just like,
some interesting moments.
Yeah. But yeah. And also Doctor Who. I'm a big Doctor Who fan. And so BBC's been playing with. Like the 50th anniversary was in a, you could watch it in the movie theater and stateside. Yeah. So, and that was when I was like, well, that's fine with me. Okay. I'll watch it 3D in a movie theater. Why not? So, but I want to circle back to comics in terms of the limitation though, is therefore, you know, we have digital comics, which we don't have to worry about page count terribly, except, you know, how much, you pay the artists.
They often do. They do still break them into pages frequently.
Right.
But my heart breaks a little. Every time, because when it too much reproduces the structure of a technology that it's no longer coupled to, that always makes me a little sad.
Yeah, because do you want to talk about, like, because DC went to like 22 pages not too long ago. I'm not sure they're still at 22 pages or not. And this is from a guy who used to be a DC Comics fan, so like I just stopped. But it was amazing how much like the 2 pages they dropped affected the storytelling. Because it's like you lost a whole beat, you know, of a subplot. You can't have a subplot anymore. It felt like the comics I was reading, I was like, where's the subplot? Like, there's no...
We probably 22 is awfully short.
Yeah.
And you have to really cram things in.
Right. And I was reading a review of, to prepare for talking to you today, it was like the review of Sculptor, and you said you had 3 pages of two people eating dinner, and that's like 30 pages. You know,
it is literally 30 pages.
Actually. Yeah, so that's like 2 Marvel comics right there. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So, but so the limitations of the medium, like there's print and then there's digital, as you say, like, and also if I understand this discussion, the argument, right, is that because it's digital, we don't have to be tied to the print layout anymore. We just do boxes and stuff. And then the guided view of like comiXology, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, how is that? Does that fix the problem? I'm using air quotes.
No. The problems are still there. No, I think, you know, in terms of, you know, the cranky old man usability argument for me is that if I'm thinking about the mode of navigation while I'm navigating, something's very, very wrong. You know, by the time I've made it to panel 3 on page 1, I should no longer be thinking about how I get from place to place. And so when you have an ever-changing mode of navigation, when you have some sort of guided view that gets you from panel to panel, but then in some way you are aware that now you're moving on to the next page and now you're changing mode of navigation again, that's no good. You shouldn't have to look. You shouldn't have to think.
Right.
Navigating on an iPad should be your thumb going like that. That this should be never any more than that. Never any more. You know, I did a lot of comics in the early days, like 96, 97, where I would have like hundreds of panels just in a single scroll. So I thought, why bother having pages at all, why not just make the whole, make the screen a window and just navigate through it? So I thought, okay, vertical, horizontal, staircase, whatever. But there it was a single mode navigation because I was scrolling, right? So it's the same basic idea, even though they're radically different. The idea is however you got from 1 to 2 and 2 to 3, that's how you get from 3 to 4 and 4 to 5. And that should be that way through the whole time. And that's how it becomes invisible, because in a storytelling medium in which you hope that people are going to be losing themselves in the world of the story, the characters, the plot, the, you know, the environment, the last thing you need is to be constantly yanked back to the glowing screen and your fingers on a keyboard. That just sucks. And I think that a lot of the solutions we've come up with are kludgy. And one of the things that just drives me nuts is that I really thought by the turn of the century we would have ditched the idea of keeping a vertical page on a horizontal screen.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about appropriating the shape of the previous technology and trying to shoehorn it into the new one. That's criminal. That is so wrong.
Well, DC Comics had digital only comics, right? Where it was horizontal.
Yeah, you've seen some landscape pages. Yeah, they're beginning to do it.
And actually, one of my favorite comics of recent is actually Stars Digital. It was a Superman Adventures digital only comic, and it was illustrated by Jock. I'm not sure that's his name, like Jock. That's his only name, but it's like Cher, I guess. But the digital comics were like, you know, just horizontal, but they went to go publish them for print, as you do, because there were, I don't know what, 12 pages each on digital, and they, like, you know, one issue would be 2 issues, and so they would actually stack the blocks to make one big issue.
You really can't have it both ways. I really, you know, we took a bad turn when comics companies decided that they needed some kind of push button solution that would allow them to create for one technology, for one format, and have it magically transformed to the other. You need to design for the device. I believe in designing for the device. Responsive design is all well and good for many types of media.
Okay.
But in comics, the shape of the presentation is essential to the presentation. It's part of the soul of what this medium is what shape it takes. It matters with comics. And so I think it does violence to the work itself to think that you can just throw it into the meat grinder and have it created for one form factor, one aspect ratio in print, and have it just automatically sent to, like, let's say, landscape format on an iPhone. Now, you can, if you choose, you can just have every single panel be a square, have it relatively low res, or, you know, in other words, total res in terms of like how much detail you actually put into the panel, lettering large enough, that sort of thing. And then, yeah, you could have 2 across if you're reading it on the bus, or, you know, maybe 4, you know, 2x2 or 2x3 on your pad, and maybe many more panels on the screen. And that's a design decision that, it's not entirely illegitimate. You could do interesting things with that if you just make sure that the integrity of each and every box is good. But it does overlook what I think is one of the most unique things about comics, which is the temporal map, and, you know, creating something in which you're seeing a map of time where past, present, and future is all around you. This is one of the only media we have in which we're rising above that temporal landscape. All other art forms, it's always now. You know, and whether you're looking at a play or reading a book or watching a movie, there's just that sense of being on the now treadmill, right? So you know, to me, the survival of comics is linked to its unique properties. Otherwise, well, you might as well watch a movie if it's just trying to be a poor man's movie. You might as well watch the real thing. So that aspect of it, I think, you know, we're overlooking that if we slice and dice it to the point where all we really care about is being able to shoehorn it into a variety of formats. I think that's a mistake. But you see, that's the cranky old man.
Well, like, you've offered cranky old man. I'll offer my cranky old man. Is that I'm not a big fan of modern comics. I feel like it's everything is, and I've come to realize that it's me. because they keep on making comics without my like permission. But is that I love, you talk about how you we talked about this before. You talked about this in interviews. Is that the tools of technology that you have to make comics now are amazing, because you just draw something, fix it, right? And as a writer, I feel like revising is awesome, because I don't feel like I'm a writer, I'm an editor. But but what I love is the original comic art, where you have the artist, you have the inker, you have the word balloonist, and it's all in this page, this original comic book page. And there is this artifact that, you know, to get 24 pages in the old school 80s and whatever, what have you, is that once the artist is done, once it's inked, we're in there. You know, we're like, this is what that has to work. And so that means like editing, fixing things, white out, bring it out there, you know, just like every trick in the book to get this to work right. And I felt like, wow, there's so much manpower. Maybe creativity went to it, but creativity went to it.
Yeah, quite a lot. But yeah, but it was all corralled onto that one rectangular piece of Bristol board. Yeah.
Right. And I love that, because I feel like we're all in agreement. This is what we're building. And then, you know, you take, you know, photos. I could guess how comics can, you know, after that, you know, photos and made into a book or whatever, what have you. But yeah, I love that. And then I see modern comics, which I feel like they're just, you know, exercises in exercising, I guess. I don't know. I just feel like, we'll just draw some stuff here. We have enough room for all the text, so we'll just have this gigantic word balloon here, and I'll just have one big giant word balloon. We'll have several word balloons take up a page. Who needs editing? You know, whatever. So it's just like, just because we can fit it in, all editing this, I feel like, you know, there's no thing like, hey, this artist came in, drew this elegant looking page. We can't overload it with words. We have to edit down the words to fit the beats. The editor comes in and says, this doesn't fit the tone, whatever, like what have you, whatever editors do, whatever. But for comics, and so that's my cranky old man. And then
okay, well, fortunately, now thank you, Christopher, because now you've given me the opportunity to draw back the curtains and be the and bring some sunlight into the room, because I have good news for you.
Okay, good.
There's comics. Has not just gone in that direction, fortunately. Now, what you're describing probably has a lot to do with the comics we remember from when we were younger, and like kind of the mainstream, the superhero stuff, where you had a team, you had the writer and the artist and the inker. These were all different people, the letterer and all.
Right.
But increasingly, a much bigger part of the comics world is being done by people who are very sensitive to the problems you're talking about, and it's often one person. And these are, you know, a lot of comics for kids, or a lot of parts of the graphic novels movement or the webcomics movement now has moved pretty far away from that stuff. Now, if you want to pick up the latest issue of Wolverine or Iron Man with the 22 pages, you're definitely going to be running into a lot of the problems that you ran into. But I'm seeing there's been a really strong movement away from that kind of storytelling. And it's often just one cartoonist doing the whole job, writing and drawing. They've got more room, first of all. They'll often be working like 300 or 400 pages like I did on this latest one. And they'll take the time. And they don't overload it with giant word balloons filled with lots of words. You may turn those pages faster. You may be annoyed that you paid all that money for that book and you just read the whole thing in 2 hours on the bus. But the pace is much more naturalistic. And the integration of words and pictures is much more mature too. And, you know, I got to see in real time that thing about, like, as new technologies come along, you start by adapting the ways of the old. I saw that in real time, because when we started getting those 200 and 300 page formats, what do we do? Well, we thought, oh, now I can cram in even more rushed, crowded storytelling and get more storytelling done. And it actually took a while. It took people like Craig Thompson to come along and say, you know what? I just realized I have all these pages. If I want to have 20 pages of snow melting, I can do that. You know? And there are times when the story really needs 20 pages of snow melting, where that is exactly the right decision as a storyteller. That's happening. That's happening a lot more. Much more harmonious word-picture combinations, more naturalistic storytelling. and moving away from the kind of the weird artifice that comes from trying to justify the fact that you just paid $4 for 22 pages, which is not a good, our price per minute has not been good in the superhero realm in recent years. But no, there's a lot of good news, I promise you. Like when we're done, I'll send you a list of great graphic novels to check out.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. Like, just like if you, it's more of an independent movement. Mm-hmm. It's like, so yeah, I totally agree, because that's why, you know, people who can rise up and have that skill sets can make great comics that way. And the tools are liberating in that way.
And also the independents are no longer the independents in a lot of ways. What we thought of when we were young and reading superhero comics, we thought of the mainstream as being Marvel and DC, maybe Dark Horse or something. And then the alternative or the independent stuff, you know, that was everything else, right? Yeah. Well, now the real mainstream are things like Persepolis, you know, the graphic novel about growing up in Iran by Marjan Satrapi. Mm. And that's in probably 30 languages by now, and it's assigned in classrooms all over the country. Or Raina Telgemeier's graphic novels like Smile and Drama for middle school age readers, and those things have she sold in the millions. Mm. Now those are the true mainstream, you know, and they eclipse, you know, like the latest issue of Iron Man, which is, you know, I don't know what it's selling, but it's not in those numbers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, cool. Yeah. Well, that gives me hope.
So. There's good news. Yes. I promise you, comics are in good shape.
Cool. Awesome. Well, I think it's a good stopping point for the episode. How can people find you on the internet?
I am at the intuitively named scottmcleod.com. Okay.
And thank you so much for being on the show, and I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Christopher.